Tonight's shiur, Parshiyos Matos Masei, to finish up Sefer Bamidbar. It says in the pasuk, "As Bilam ben Beor hargu becharav," they killed Bilam by the sword. Rashi says, "Hu bal Yisrael ve'chlif umanuso bemunasam." So along came Bilam, and he switched their device with his. She'ein noshim ela befiem. Ve'al yidei tefila u'bakasha, that how are Yisrael saved? They're saved with their mouths, by davening, tefila, bakasha. And so what did he do? Bilam, he came and he tafas emunasam, he grabbed their device, what they use, and he was mekalo with his mouth, just like they use their mouth, Yisrael. So he used his mouth. But in the end, afu ba'o alav v'chlifu emunasam b'emunas emuna omos. But what did the Klal Yisrael do? They switched with him. The goyim come along, and shebayin becharban, they come with their cherev and they kill, as it says, al charb chatichya. So along came the yidden and said, okay, now we're going to use his device and kill him with the sword. And in the end, that's how Bilam was killed. Chafetz Chaim says that we see from here the kli emunaso, and the craftsman's kli, as the literally says, of Yisrael is their mouth. And just like a craftsman, he can't do his job unless he has a proper kli, so too, Klal Yisrael, unless they have a proper kli, their mouths are in shape, that's the only way they can be successful. Brings here a maisa with Rav Moshe Schwab Zatzal. He was a mashgiach in Gateshead, and once his talmidim asked him, "How did he become so great in Torah?" So he related that it all stemmed from way back when he was a bacher, and he was living in Germany, and his brother had went to Lita to learn in by Rav Elchanan Wasserman Zatzal. Hashem yikom damo. So he said, "I didn't want to go there because I was very spoiled, like mefunak, you know. I needed proper conditions and meals, and over there in Lita, you know, the bachur would rough it, you know. I couldn't live like that." And my brother said, "Why don't you come just for a visit, check out the yeshiva, this and that? You know, you don't have to stay. You don't like it, go back. Just come." So he said, "I decided, okay, fine, I'll just go visit my brother." So as soon as I got there, I said, "Well, this is not for me. I like the way they're, you know, beds they're sleeping on, everything, you know, old, and I could never stay in such a place." But my brother said, "Okay, just wait till after lunch, and then..." So I wasn't so happy about that either, he said, because what they served for lunch wasn't my exactly idea of food. But, okay. But then something happened which almost changed my life. Says, "What was that?" We're sitting at the table there at the lunch in the Chadar Ochel, and this woman who came was just served the meals. So she served this pitcher of hot tea, boiling hot tea. She put down, and by accident, one of the bachram inadvertently, you know, hit the thing of tea, the pitcher of tea, and it fell down on the bachar next to him. Now, you can tell the guy was like doubling over in pain. Imagine boiling hot water like falling on you. The guy, right. So, what would your average reaction be of your average person? They're screaming at the guy, "You idiot, look what you did, you know." Start screaming at him. But first, the bachur didn't scream. He held it, you can see, he held it back. He didn't want to scream. Why? Because he didn't want to make his friend feel bad for what he did. He didn't mean to do it. And he held it back. That was number one. That itself was godless. But more than that, what did he do? He gets up and he tells the lady, he says, "Can you please bring these bachram another pitcher of tea?" He says, "Because it's spilt, and this guy didn't mean to, but it was, you know, he spilt the tea, and the bachram are thirsty and they need something to drink, you know. So could you please bring a thing of tea?" And also the guy that spilt it, he said it wasn't his fault, and you know, he also needs to drink, you know, so please. So he said, "I was just taken aback. Couldn't believe it. Like, what's going through this bachur's mind? You know, at this time, instead of screaming, he holds it in, not to hurt the guy's feelings. And what is he thinking about the whole time? The other bachur, how thirsty they are." So he said, "When I saw that, he said, this is the place for me." And I ended up staying in the yeshiva by Rav Elchanan. So he points out over here, so we see this bachur that held it back, what tremendous chus he has. Not only the act itself, but because this Rav Moshe saw what was going on. Because of that, he stayed in yeshiva and he became the mashgiach of Rav Keitzer. And how many boys did he help? And he produced, you know, great Torah personalities. He himself, all because he stayed on by Rav Elchanan. And why was that? Because this bachur didn't scream. This one act, this bachur created the mashgiach in Keitzer. On the pasuk at Sadah v'tzamid, bracelets and footbands, brings here a maisa that was happened in an old shul in the town called Tarnopol. He said there was in the shul they used to sell liyas for the Yamim Noraim or Shani Yom Kippur, whatever. And there was one kibud that always the same person got. His name was Roshalom Dankner. He was a wealthy guy in the community, and his thing was psicha of neila. To open the aron for neila, that was his thing. He made sure he, whatever it cost, he would always outbid everybody, and he made sure he bought the psicha for neila. This was year after year. Fine. What happens is things sometimes happen. This Shalom Dankner, he lost his wealth, lost everything, and became a poor man. So when that happened, the gabayim in the shul didn't know what to do, because they felt really bad for him, and he started, you know, people were going to bid for the psicha of Neila, and you know, he wouldn't be able to handle the bidding, and he would obviously not get it. They felt terrible because for year after year after year, he was always getting this kibbutz. So the gabayim discussed the matter before Yontov, and they came to a decision what they're going to do. They're going to let it out amongst the kehillah that nobody should outbid. They're going to start off with a very, very low price that even he can afford, Rav Shalom, and then nobody should outbid him. Let it go and let him get his kibbutz. That's what they did. You know, I said $5 or whatever it was, and something he could handle, and then quiet, nobody bid anymore. He got the psicha for neila. Good. So it worked, and so it continued for a number of years. However, one year, some gvir in the community, he wanted psicha for neila. So when they started the bidding, $5, he said $10, and all of a sudden, people started bidding for it. And of course, Rav Shalom couldn't bid, he couldn't afford it, and he was sitting there. And the gabayim didn't know what to do, because on the one hand, you know, they felt bad, didn't want to, you know, take away this kibbutz from Rav Shalom, but again, they couldn't stop the bidding, because that would be taking money away from the shul that's coming to the shul. So they had no other choice, they had to let the bidding continue. So they're going higher and higher and higher and higher and higher. So all of a sudden, when one of when Gvir thought he was going to win the kibbutz, all of a sudden, from the Ezra's Nashim, this sack of something came flying over from the Ezra's Nashim and fell out on the table there in front of the Gabayim. So he was like looking like, what was that? So they go over to this little bag and they open it up, and it's full of diamonds and pearls and all precious stones, like a whole sack of precious stones. So where did that come from? That came from Rav Shalom's wife. Right, they're poor, but she never got rid of her. She always had all her fancy diamonds and jewelry, whatever, that she kept, that she never got rid of. And she saw that her husband wasn't getting to get the psicha, so she wanted to outbid everybody, and she threw the pack of all her jewelry, which she took off, and threw it in the Ezra's Kvarim, so she could, so her husband could have the psicha for Neil. So everybody was, taken aback by what had happened, and he got his kibud. And after Yontuf, the gabayim came to her and says, here's your jewels back. It's very nice what you did, but it's okay. Here, take it. And she said, no, nothing doing. Like, listen, I gave it al das that my husband should have the kibud. So that's it. It's a neder. It's a neder nidre tzedakah. Take it. It's yours, and that's it. So what did they do? They decided they're going to do something special, not just like sell it and take the money, but they took the actual diamonds and jewels and they made a beautiful paroches, a white paroches, and they sewed them in, the jewels into the paroches, and they would put up this paroches only for like Yom Kippur. And it was there just for a thing till the end of Neila, and there's two gabayim, strong gabayim standing next to it to protect it, nobody should steal it, and then they would put it away in the safe for the next year. Also to remember this mice. Okay. Yeah, it's a very interesting vort here. It starts with the Bnei Gad Bnei Reuven. Right. First of all, it says that Bnei Gad Bnei, they wanted to stay on the Aver Yarden because they wanted they had a lot of possessions, a lot of livestock, right, animals, whatever, and a lot of grazing land over there, and they wanted to stay over there. So Rashi says that we see from the way they spoke that they were money hungry. That they were running after their money. Now it's not just they just happened to have a lot of money, so they need a place, you know, for their plan. No, the ikur by them was the money. Right? Where do we see this? So Rashi says, because that's in the pasuk Vayomru Gidra son Nivne leMikneinu po. We're going to build pens like these places to put our animals here. V'arim leTapenu, and also cities for our kids. So what came first? Their animals, their possessions, and for their kids and their families, they also need something. So they see they put their animals first. That they were Rashi says Chasim hayu al mamonam yoter mibneihem v'notehem. They cared more about their money than they cared about their children. Okay, so Rashi says. So he brings from Yitzhak Nevensal, a sefer called Duda Yitzhak, a beautiful chap. He says that the Gemara, famous Gemara, and Rashi brings it also here in the Parsha, Periklamet Hei Yudalad. Rashi brings that with the Ari Mikla. Right, it says that there are six main Ari Mikla, three in Eretz Yisrael and three in Aver HaYarden. Right, Gemara says in Makos, brings the Torah, says it, the Gemara in Makos, though, asks that Lechur is not balanced. Why? Because in Eretz Yisrael proper, there were 9.5 Shvatim, and in Aver HaYarden, there was the remaining 2.5, right? There was Reuven Gad and Chatzi Menashe. So it's not proportional. Why have three here and three here, Ari Miklat? It should be most of the Ari Miklat should have, five there and one there, whatever, because it is most of the people are in Eretz Yisrael, not in Eretz Yarden. So, famous Gemara, the Gemara says the reason why they had the three and three is because that in an Eretz Yarden, Nefishe Rotzchim. There were a lot of murders going on over there. A lot of murders, so therefore they needed proportion. Murder-wise, there was just a amount of murders. Even though there was not that many people, but there was a lot of murders according to the amount of people they had. And therefore they needed that many Ari Mikla. He says a beautiful chav. He says, where did all these murders come from? Why? What's the source of all these murders? So he says, we saw. Where did Reuven and Gad, right? Why would they want Aver HaYarden? Because they were money hungry. They put their chas and their money more than their families. So we see what came out of that. Shchichei Rotzchim. Right? People that are money hungry, that leads to one thing leads to another, until you become Shchichei Rotzchim. He also has another interesting chav. That you read about it, and you say it, but when you look a little carefully, it's a pella. What's that? Where's Menashe getting into the picture? It says at the beginning right here that Reuven and Gad said they had a lot of livestock, whatever, and then they needed a place for them. Reuven and Gad, and they said we want to live over here. Reuven and Gad, and then Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, fine. So Reuven and Gad and Chetzi Menashe, they will be over here. And so he said two questions. First of all, where does Menashe get into the picture? They didn't ask for it. They didn't say we want also a place for our. They didn't say that. That was only Reuven and Gad. So what's Menashe doing there? Number one. Question number two is, why Chetzi Menashe? If you're going to put Menashe there for whatever reason, what's all of Menashe over there? Why Chetzi? Pella. You know, we keep saying it, but when you think about it, it's... So he says, also, nice chav, says that, first of all, why Menashe? Menashe, they didn't ask for it. But Menashe is from Yosef, right? And they got a bracha, from Yaakov, they should be like Dagim. And Dagim is our, since they're under the water, they're not susceptible to Ayin Hara. They have a protector to protect it from Ayin Hara. Memele, Moshe wanted to protect Bnei Gad Reuven, since they had so much money, so many possessions, so they're liable to have a big Ayin Hara against them. So to protect them against the Ayin Hara, he put Menashe there, because Menashe has like the fish, they're protected from Ayin Hara. Why Chetzi? So put the whole Menashe there. Said no. If Moshe Rabbeinu failed, then he's going to put the whole thing there. For he's going to have full three tribes over there on the Eber Yarden. What's going to happen is it's going to create a nituk, a separation between them and the rest of Klal Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu wants to make sure there's a connection between the two, and therefore he just put half of Menashe, so half here, half there, and there can be the connection between the two sides, the link. Brings here an interesting story. Says there was once a Talmud Chacham, and he was running a whole bunch of kolalim, which means he raised money for a few different kolalim, which means to do a lot of work, a lot of legwork and fundraising. Anyways, he got a word one day that a certain gvir in London, right in England, was able to see him, but he couldn't see him. He has to see him very soon, in a few hours, whatever. So he said, wow, this is a golden opportunity. So he quickly just dashed off to the airport and went up to the LL counter and says, please, I need a ticket for the flight now. I got to go, urgent. So she looks at him. He says, are you out of your mind? He says, the flight's leaving in like 10 minutes. So he says, oh, okay, but I have to get on the flight. It's important. I have to immediately get to England. He goes, sir, with all due respect, we say 3 hours before I come to the airport, but not 10 minutes before. You can't do that. I'm sorry. You have to take another flight. He goes, no, I need this flight. So she says, I can't apologize. I can't. So he pulls out, he had a frequent flyers card, he used to fly quite often with El Al, so he says, look, I'm a frequent flyer, so she says, okay, let me speak to the Minahel, So she calls the Minahel, talking back and forth, she says, okay, we'll let you on the flight, but only under one condition. We can't wait for you, people have to flight to catch, the plane's got to leave, and we can't wait for you, so you have to go on immediately, meaning you can't take anything with you. You can't take even a carry-on, nothing. Why? Because normally you have to go through security, and then there's no time for security. You have to go straight onto the plane, so you're not allowed to take anything, nothing. So he goes, come on, what about my talus and fill-in? I'm staying there overnight, my talus and fill-in. No, so he thought, okay, he's not going to push his luck. He was lucky enough to get on the flight, fine. So he left his stuff, and he went on with a suit, nothing. No talus, no tefillin, no nothing. Fine, so he goes on flight, has an appointment, everything works out. So the next morning, he goes to shul, but he doesn't have any talus and tefillin. So he goes over to a fellow, a random person there, and he's in shul. He says, I don't know about any talus and tefillin. Do you mind? Can I borrow your talus and tefillin? So the guy says, yeah, sure. So he gives it to the talus and tefillin. So he puts on a talus and he starts unwrapping the tefillin, put it on. He notices they didn't look so good. They were not like puzzle, but they were definitely not in very good condition, So after he finished using them, he didn't give it back to the guy. He said, listen, I hope you don't mind me telling you this, but, your tefillin are, not any good, great jakes, And he says, I'll tell you what. He says, I'm going back now to Eretz Yisrael. He told the guy, I'll arrange to get you a nice new pair of tefillin. So he goes, oh, wow, so nice, fine. So he leaves, and he goes back to Israel, and he kept his promise. As soon as he came back, he bought a nice pair of tefillin, and he sent it back to this guy in London that lent him the tefillin, like he promised. Right. So what happens? A few days later, in the mail, he gets a check. A big, big check for his, for the kolalim or whatever. So he contacts the guy, and he goes, oh, thank you so much, what's this all about? So as it happens, he didn't realize, but this guy was a wealthy guy. And he said that I have monies I give away to yeshivas and things like that. So I usually distribute to this yeshiva and that yeshiva, different places, whatever. But when I saw that, you're also, collecting for yeshiva, but I saw how you just didn't care about, your institutions, your things. You care about people. Here you are. You didn't know me from anything. You went out and you got me a pair of tefillin. Right? I saw that you care about others. If you care about others, says, I want to give you the money. So all the monies I give to all the yeshivas and everything, I put it into one check and send it to you. You see the tremendous siyata d'shmaya, and it was all because he got on the flight with talus and tefillin, right? That he ended up borrowing from this guy who ended up sending him the check. Had he gone with his talus and tefillin, so here, he got on the flight. You think, oh, this is terrible. Meanwhile, in the end, that's what got him the big bucks. Okay. An interesting shaila here, a little weird, but it's what happens in the Kehillah in America, that there is a shul, and is on Shabbos. Okay, on Shabbos, the Gabbai sees this guest walk in, and he had a good eye. You know, he can see who's the rich people. You know, walks in. You know, he says, "Oh, you know, if he's a good guy, to give him a nice aliyah, get a nice, you know, donation for the shul." You know, fine. So he calls him up for an aliyah, and beer, whatever, is gives an aliyah, and then he makes a mishaberach so he can get you know, donation for the shul. So the guy says you know, how much, you know, turns to him, how much you give him, you know, said, and a donation. So he gets $2,000. $2,000. So the great, whatever, finished mishaberach, shkayach, that was that. Fine. So after Motzi Shabbos, the Gabbai, you know, wants to cash in, you know. So he goes to the gate, says, you know, came to collect the money. So he says, "Oh yeah, here," and he had it ready in an envelope. He says, "Here you go." And the Gabbai opens up the envelope and he sees $200. So he says to the Gvir, "Excuse me, what's this?" He goes, "What do you mean? I made a donation Shabbos, man, you know, this morning, $200. He goes, "What do you mean $200? You said $2,000, $200. I said $2,000. He goes, "What are you talking about, $2,000? No way, I'm not going to get $2,000. I'm going to get $2,000. He goes, "I'm telling you, you said $2,000. What are you talking about?" So the Gabbai said, "Well, yeah, you don't believe me?" He says, "No, I don't believe you. I'm telling you it's $200. He says, "Okay, come with me." So what happens? He takes him to his office, and he pulls out a recorder, and he presses the play button, and he hears what's went on in shul that morning, right? The Gabbai put a little recorder underneath the bima, and he, before Shabbos, you know, put it on and recorded the whole davening. So just in case this would happen, that some gevir would say something, and exactly, you know, he would have a proof. So sure enough, they hear the mishabera, yeah, and he'll tell you how much you give, and he said $2,000, $2,000. Here, it's all there on tape. Here, he says, "Yeah, so you see, I told you $2,000. So the guy, Gvir looks up at me and goes, "What?" He says, "I don't believe you. How can you do such a thing? Taping me on Shabbos?" He grabs the $200 from me and goes, "You're not even getting the $200. Forget it." He says, I would never give money to shul, das, a shul that tapes the aliyahs on Shabbos. Forget it. I'm not." And he takes the money and runs away. Ah. So what's the Shaila? Shaila was, does he have to pay the $200, $2,000? Does he have to pay, or what's the story? So the Shaila was brought to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, Shlita, and he says, first of all, that the Gvir was right. He doesn't have to give a penny, because he would never, like he said, he would never have given money to a shul that does something so terrible as taping people on Shabbos. Okay? So he doesn't have to give anything, number one. However, he says, but it's not fair that the shul should lose out. Because here's an aliyah, they're supposed to get money, and now they're getting any money. And why aren't they getting any money? Because the Gabbai taped them. So it's the Gabbai's fault, and the Gabbai caused the shul a loss, so therefore he says the Gabbai has to pay. But how much does he have to pay? So he says, though, but he doesn't have to pay $2,000, only has to pay $200. Why? Because Lamaisa, there was no aidus, you know, had it not been that he would have taped them, he wouldn't have been able to get more than $200 out of the gvir, because there's no aidus, and there was his word against his word. So he said $200, so he would have to accept the $200. There's no proof, right? So therefore, that's the real loss, that the, in other words, had he not taped them, he would have caused, you know, there would have been $200, and because he taped them, that $200 was lost. So therefore, he says the Gabbai should pay $200, which he caused us to lose for the show. Okay. Okay. It's an interesting word from Rav Shach, which is matim now for the 3 weeks. But we'll just makdim with the maisa that led to this. That there was a couple that they came with a shaila, and that is, they don't understand what's happening to them. They have a nice fancy car, and in 1 month they got into 3 accidents. First time the car was almost total, completely, pretty much was total, completely. They had to get a new car, right? The insurance bought them a new car. Then a week later, whatever, they got into another accident. And then after that, they got it fixed, and then they got into another accident. And then one accident after another. So they were like scared of going into their car. And they said, you think that, you know, but what do we do? Said, what is this happening to us? It's not like we're doing anything bad with our car. Lahafach said, we're very big at Bali Chesed. We use our car for all kinds of chesedim. But he says, the guy said, myself, my wife, and we use the car constantly for chesedness. So we don't understand what's going on. Well, so I asked Rav Zilberstein, what can he make of it? Of course, he's not a Navi, but he said, listen, I can. Let me just tell you something that Rav Shach said. What was that? Rav Shach brings a Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Amud Beis, that says, brings the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that says, Alma Almeh Avda Haaretz. Right? Why was there a Churban? Churban Beis Amigdash. Why did it happen? So the Gemara says that this question, why did it happen, okay, was asked, says the Gemara, to the Chachamim, to the Chachamim, to the Nevi'im, to the Torah, to the Malachi Hashares, ve'af echad me'am lo yada latet tshuva l'sheila. Nobody was able to give an answer. Nobody knew. The Chachamim and the Torah, the Malachi Hashares. Nobody knew an answer. Until, says the Gemara, Ad Shekodesh Baruch Hu be'atz kodo chatzmo, until Hashem himself said, you know why? Al azvam es torasi asher nasati lifneihem. Because they left my Torah. So ask Rav Shach Abam Kasha. He says, well, I don't understand. He said, Pasha, don't understand. He said, the Jews were punished, right? They're punished. So he says, I don't understand. Why were they punished? Right? Whatever they did, nobody was able to point their fingers and know what happened. Say, okay, some guy in the street didn't know. But we're not talking about a guy in the street. The Chachamim, right? The Torah, the Nevi'im. The Malachi Asharis did not know. So if they didn't know, what do you want from the Jewish people? The Malachi Asharis didn't know why may have darts. So how can we blame the Jewish people? Oh, you see, you should have known. And come on, the Malachi Asharis didn't know. We were supposed to know. And yet, apparently, yeah, because there was a Churban. So he said he had this kasha. He said he was smashing his head against the wall. He couldn't get an answer. He said he couldn't find it. Finally, he says, Lechura, you have to say the following. What is that? That a person knows about the emes that concerning himself more than any other person. In other words, even when nobody can know, but if it's something concerning me, I can know what nobody else can know, because it's me. Mimela, that's a shot over here. That and fine, the Malachim, the Torah, Nevi'im, whatever, they couldn't know, but Klal Yisrael themselves knew. Why? Because they could have known, because they were expected to know, because it was them. And a person, as the Pasuk says, that Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, right? A person's heart knows himself. And that's a nafkamina, you know, when it comes to eating on Yom Kippur. A doctor says, you know, you know you're okay. And the person says, you know, I'm not okay. He's allowed to eat because he knows himself more than anybody. So too, when it comes to sins also, veras, right? That even the Malchei Sharis, they don't know. But if you really, really look into it, you could know, because it's you. So Mele, they could have known, they didn't, that's why there was a Churban. So he turned to this couple, and he says, I don't know, you know, okay, I'm not a Navi, you can't tell exactly what is happening, but you could know, because it's happening to you. So other people, if you really, you know, do some introspection, and you think about it very deeply, Chesed and Nefesh, you'll get Siyata Shemaya, because we see from here that what other people can't know, you yourself could know, and you're expected to know. So just a matter of making a proper Chesed and Nefesh. Okay, something from Parshas Maaseh. Maaseh B'nei Yisrael is an interesting little al-shech that he says, why is it called Maaseh B'nei Yisrael? He says, because Klal Yisrael, they were not supposed to be journeying in the desert. There shouldn't have been all these masavs. They were supposed to go straight into Eretz Yisrael. So the Chadash Rei Miyom Mechorav, right? Hashem quickly wanted to get them to Eretz Yisrael. They did a 3-day journey to Har Chorav. They did it in 11 days. They did it in 3 days, right? Hashem wanted them to go quickly, jing, get into Eretz Yisrael, and that's that. But it's in the Meragli, whatever, they had to spend 40 years in the desert. So all the traveling around the masavs was why? It was because of Bnei Yisrael. So therefore, it's that's why it's Mas'ei B'nei Yisrael. Their journeys, because they cause themselves to be journeying. It's their fault. Brings here an interesting Maisa from Shikun Square in America, near Muncie. And what happened was, he says, so one day the Hatzalah gets a call, a tragedy. He says a little kid fell off the, there was a house, a three-story house. The kid fell from the third story onto the street. So they heard that, they're just getting ready for the worst. I mean, like falling three stories onto the pavement, it's like goodbye. So anyways, they came to the scene, and they were shocked because the kid was bruised up a little bit, but he was fine. He was back, all right. He was conscious. They didn't expect him to be alive. Anyway, so he went to the hospital to check him out, and everything was fine. Okay, a little scratched up, but he was okay. So the doctors were amazed. Said, how could it be? How can a kid fall three stories and just like walk away like that? It's impossible. So the doctors themselves sent a group to check out the house and that, to see exactly what had happened. So they found out what had happened. What was that? That this house used to be a one-story house, and then the owners decided to add another couple of stories. Okay, now when it was a one-story house, regular. Okay, so along the roof there was a gutter, right, where the water to drain in, right. So it went across the whole roof, whatever. So then when the owner added the two stories, so there's no need for the gutter now it's in the middle of the wall or the bottom third of the wall. It belongs on by the roof. But the gutter remained there. It remains on the side of the house. And when he added the two stories, he still had the gutter running across there. So what had happened? The kid fell from the top story. But as he was falling, his clothes got caught in the gutter. And it was on by the two stories down, right? It was on the gutter, got caught. So it kind of broke his fall, a little, the thing. And then he fell down from there after again, to the bottom. But that ended up, therefore, in the end, was really only a one-story fall, not a three-story fall. And because of that, it saved his life. So what's the Pella? The Pella is that, what is that? What was that gutter doing in there, right? We said it belonged on the roof, not on the first story. So what happened was when the owners of the building, of the house, when they wanted to add the two stories, they went to the Rebbe, the Gaibid of Square, and they asked him. His name was Rabbi Moshe Neischlitz, that's all. And they asked him about, can we take away the gutter? Remove the gutter. We're adding another two stories. And he said, don't take away the gutter. Leave it. So they left it. Even though it looked really weird, in a nice big house, and there's a gutter going across the middle of the house, it looked very strange. But the owner said, "Listen, the Rebbe said, and he said, don't touch the gutters." They left the gutter, and that was that for 20 years. Nobody understood why. Whatever. 20 years later, the kid fell down and saved his life, all because of the Emunas Chachamim that the Balabais had in listening to the Rebbe. The obvious question, which I'm sure you're all asking, is, well, why did the Rebbe say to leave the gutter? So perhaps he suggests that Rav Zilberstein, that there is a makor for that, and that is, it's a Gemara in Chulin, Daf Kuf Hei Amud Beis. It says over there was once a man, and he put a barrel underneath his gutter, and then the shadim, the demons, were mazikim. So when the shadim were asked, why are you hurting this poor guy? What did he do? And so they answered that we live underneath the gutter. And that's our place where we live. And we put it down as this barrel, so it took away our living quarters over here. So that's why we're mazikin, right? So connected with that, it could be that, maybe by taking away the gutter, the Rebbe held that, you're messing with the demons. Therefore, he said, better just to leave the gutter. And in the end, as we saw, it ended up saving them. Okay, so one last thing for today. Speaking about houses, let's end up with a short idea from the Ger Rebbe, that there was once a Avreich, who was a Chassid Gur, and he was looking to buy an apartment. So he went to the Rebbe, this was the Rebbe Pinchas Menachem Zatzal, and he asked him, what should I look for, when I'm looking for an apartment to buy? So the Rebbe told him like this, he says, walk down the street and look at the various apartments, and when you see one that they added an addition, like the building on the roof, sometimes people on the top floor, they added an extra room or whatever on the roof. He says, when you see a building they added on, like an extra room on the roof, he says, that's the building you should buy in. So he says, what kesher? What was it? So he says, he explained why. He said, because the people, if you want to build on the roof like that, you have to get permission from all the people in the building. So the fact that somebody built on there, what does that mean? It means all the people in the building gave their okay. So that shows that they're tovas ayin, that the people live in that building, they're all willing to help other people. They're not selfish people. They want to find, you want to build, and they gave the okay. They have a tov ayin. So in a building that are tov ayin, he says, that's the building you should live in. And similarly, there was Rav Chaim Greinerman, that somebody asked him about where to live, to buy, and he said that you should buy an apartment on the ground floor. So, the lowest floor possible there. So they asked him, why? So he says, because people living in the upper floors, they don't mean to, but they end up damaging sometimes the people on the lower levels. Like their laundry, their hang drips down on the thing, or they throws a cigarette, button that lands and burns the guy's laundry on the floor underneath whatever, right? So it's inevitable that you end up, damaging. So the guy on the bottom floor, he doesn't damage anybody, he's on the bottom. He's a damagee, not a damager. So he says, always better to be a damagee than rather being a damager. Therefore you should take the bottom. Should be zoicha to find our proper dira, the right time, the right place, and await Kosh Baruch Hu to bring his dira. B'kara b'yameinu, the binyan b'samigdash, b'yehir b'yameinu. Amen.